about the train conclusion, which is summertime. Okay. So we threw that. We messed it up. Never mind.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Well, we haven't met before, so, and if I post this on my channel, people might not know who you are. So yeah. why don't we begin with a bit of your story? You told me some on email, but why don't you start there? Well, let's start with how you were raised. Were your parents Christians?
I was raised by my paternal grandparents. So I'm a child of 1968. And here in the West Country, in Devon, almost as south as you can get, really, very kind of uneventful childhood. Parents started going back to church. Grandparents started going back to church when I was about a teenager. I think they'd had some issues with a priest or a minister when I was a toddler. And though they were very favorable about it, we always seemed to live next to graveyards, churchyards. So I was always playing in churchyards and going in and out of these beautiful kind of medieval churches being kind of allured by that. I'd even sort of creep in on Sundays in some church services, as a sort of 8-year-old, and pretend to sing hymns. Never much liked to. I can remember, the clergy wives trying to get me into Sunday school and saying, "Nah, I much prefer, standing here pretending to sing hymns." But we started going back to church when I was about 12, 13. In a nearby town, they found an Anglican, a fantastic Anglican priest. He was a somewhat sort of mystic character. In fact, I ended up talking to Rod Dreher about this. We were talking about exorcists that we had known. It ended up he was a diocesan exorcist. Under the name of Obi, which sounded a bit like Obi-Wan Kenobi, but the local TV did a thing on him during the time of Ghostbusters. Gosh, when would that have been?
You're going to have to stay right in front of your device, because I notice when you turn away, the volume on your voice dips. So,
is that better?
Yeah, that's better. So just keep your volume up in terms of your – keep speaking loudly.
I was pretty much, to begin with, I didn't mind. I was somewhat frog marched to church on Sundays. Now in Britain we have this thing that school uniforms, and I had to wear my secondary school, my high school uniform, and I absolutely loathed it. Though I was kind of intrigued by the whole church thing, as something of a newcomer to liturgy, and that this seemed quite extraordinary. And but I hated the fact that I had to wear my school uniform. That was just crazy. And anyway, this priest said to me, "Look, I'll do a deal. If you become an altar server, then you won't have to wear the school uniform because you'll have a robe." I like this guy. He's a real, elderly priest in his late 60s. He had this just way with, I think, because, he wasn't of our generation. He's way, way, way off, cassocked with cigar, and sort of a lot of mystical speaking and really endearing personality, quite theatrical. And I just thought, hey, that's really good, And so I ended up becoming an altar boy, Anglican altar boy, and here I am, Although I went through a sort of, I kind of circumnavigated it a bit all over the place. I had something of a quite profound conversion experience at 17, where, God bless him, I found my grandfather passed away in the living room, massive heart attack. I don't know, just within minutes, I didn't feel as if I pulled into darkness, but I felt as if I'd been held at that moment. So does that make sense?
But
within a couple of days, started reading the Bible properly, you know, rather than just sort of going through the motions of it. And I can remember picking up and I've still got it. If I ran through the office, I could get it now. But the kids are all playing Minecraft and Roblox and what have you. But I've got this. We had this tatty old copy of the Good News, according to St. Luke, the Good News translation, with the little cartoon pictures and that. And I took it and thought, well, I like all this stuff about Greeks and Romans and what have you. And speak to me, God. Open it up to... Now, I'm a bit dyslexic, so I'm a bit hopeless at the actual reference, but it was love your enemies was where I fell on. I think it's the sermon in the plain. I thought, well, if you're looking for a politic, you can't get much more profound than that.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this is the manifesto I'm going to take, you know, and kind of go into. I didn't go into ministry first straight away. I was allured into doing computer science,
which
was a great hobby, and I hated it as a degree. But I suddenly found out there were lots of people on the spectrum, I think, I now realize. Can you do the Rubik's Cube? I can't do it. But they were the sort of people who would do that while they were talking to you. And I realized that, you know, it was a great hobby, but really my interests were artistic in temperament and socializing and what have you. These guys were, you know, pioneering email. It was just before the internet came in, 1988-ish, around then. So I did that for a few years. Then after graduation, the call to ministry came once more. Now, at the time, my grandparents had mixed religion. You know, Granny was Catholic, Granddad Anglican. Though we practiced mostly in the Anglican Church, her Catholic spirituality was there. And I sort of felt like I had a dual passport. A bit like the one that Boris Johnson never talks about. You know? I was confirmed into the Roman Catholic Church and went to seminary. Had about 3 years in ministry, going to Canterbury, no less. We had a little tiny Catholic church right underneath the huge cathedral. So we can go and enjoy choral evensong. But when they put up the gates, where you now have to pay to go in, we got all the people that they considered, you know, troublesome and undesirable, which I feel, you know, was rather kind of romantic and saintly on our part. So we had to get stashes of McDonald's food vouchers and what have you, because they couldn't come to the cathedral. So I had that for 3 years, and I met my future wife, Frances, who was a youth worker. We left, got married, went to live with her folks up in Aberdeen in Scotland. From there, I was introduced to an Anglican bishop who essentially said, you know, I've got this fantastic parish in this, what we call in Britain a council house estate, you know, an urban, quite a challenging urban estate. I'm really looking for someone to come and take this over. And, you know, if you were received back into the Scottish Episcopal Church, the Anglican Church up here, I think you could do some good work. And half the congregation are actually Roman Catholics. So this one. This might be right for you. So we did that. and we were there for about 7-8 years. I did some university chaplaincy work at the same time, and then got the sort of draw back to Devon, to the West Country, 660 miles back down. Never thought I'd come down here, back down here. A lot of people, because the work around here is mainly service industry, you know, you get these people, kids go off to college, and there's no jobs down here for, you know, IT graduates, let alone priests. But found this place, Salcombe, which is about 15 miles from where I grew up. I'd never actually come down here as a kid. It's a sort of sailing capital of the UK. We've got a lot of people from the banking sect come down here. At the moment, we're all a bit tetchy because we're a population, normally a sleepy population, about 2,000, and we've now got about 30,000 people in town. You can imagine the sort of Salcombe Twitter, Facebook.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be very neutral about it. and some of the folks are, they have a reputation for being quite kind of pushy and are the types who know what they want and know how to get it. And, you know, and why aren't you wearing historical dress? You know, that sort of thing. You know, I exaggerate, but, you know. That's sort of 23 years of ministry. Really. I suppose I'm a career priest, and I hate the word really, but there's no other way to describe. You know, that's been, apart from a very small periods of time working in teaching IT at college level, that's been largely a diet of ministry and theology in rural and urban settings. And
COVID came to the country, and yeah. You first got my attention, someone else from the UK who follows my videos. Well, maybe we should start with Jordan Peterson. How did you find Jordan Peterson, and why did he gain your interest?
Well, I actually got him through, I think, one of your first videos on YouTube, because I'd been watching Jonathan Pajot.
Ah.
And now my wife and I have a joint interest in icon writing. We met an icon writer from the West Country about 8 years ago. Because there's lots of arty types who live and retire around here, we ran sort of parish with her, parish kind of icon writing classes, and really enjoyed it. And it's been a nice thing to do as a couple. The challenges of gold leaf and egg tempera it's fantastic. I love it. We both got really hooked into it. And I suppose I must have Googled and got Jonathan Pajot and found that these amazing insights into symbolism that really sort of just clicked in my brain. I thought this guy's amazing, particularly his stuff on Genesis and the Tree of Life and all of that. You know, it was such a wonderful supplementary instruction, way of looking at the world, really, to if you've done some of that icon writing. So, clearly he's done some amazing stuff, including this sort of stone and wood carvings that are mind-blowing. His YouTube page must have somehow recommended yours, and then I saw this thing about Jordan Peterson and thought, who's this guy, Jordan Peterson? and it was interesting kind of getting the avenue from somebody in ministry kind of shooing me into this. And I suppose what I picked up instantly was that Jordan Peterson was intrigued as to why ministers weren't kind of moving their tanks in the same direction that he was. You know, there was this great constituency of post-atheists who weren't going to become woke, they weren't going to go to any other religion or the New Age or Islam, you know, and were sort of just there in suspense. You know, and it seemed like Jordan was saying, you know, can you not hear this? That this is this whole field of people who, you know, particularly and often young men, people who've been interested in science. And I suppose I felt, well, you know, I remember in computer science, there were a lot of people like this that I was mixing with, who I think must be now scratching their head and thinking, where's my home? Everything's now looking so unreasonable, and, you know, because of, maybe because I don't fit any of the sort of categories of oppression, that I have no home, or what am I to look forward to, becoming a, you know, sort of middle-aged man who's seen as the ultimate oppressor figure. You know, I just thought, wow, he's really onto something, and he's telling us as clergy, you know, forget the woke kind of constituency. This is the people who they represent, I think, also the broken and the spiritually needy. And I just, you know, I read his 12 rules thing. I watched loads of his videos. I watched some of yours. I have to say, you're actually my you and Jonathan are my gym music. I think I'm becoming. I decided I needed to lose a bit of weight and get fit. So booked up to the local gym, and I don't know. I really must be getting old, because I just can't stand the thumpy, thumpy, thumpy music. You know, I just, particularly early in the morning when I'm trying to be a bit more spiritual, I just cannot stand it. And my gym instructor saying, what are you listening to? Oh, Paul Band of Clay. Have you heard any of his albums? and it's just, you know, I can sort of do the weights while I'm listening to good theology. I've lost my track now. I suppose I saw with Jordan and your conversation that sense that as an enormous opportunity, and why are we not all talking about this?
Well, that was exactly when I listened to Jordan, I thought, I'm going to talk to some of my colleagues about this. This is an incredible new development. And my colleagues are like, I listen to video? I could do that. You know, they might read N.T. Wright or Eugene Peterson, but listen to Jordan Peterson? I got.
Similar reactions.
Yeah.
I think he's not so well known here, but so that makes it even more difficult, and I suppose frustrating in that, you know, I've kind of increasingly felt that the hierarchies and the kind of what you might call Church of England narrative has been more towards the kind of woke stuff than the Peterson stuff.
Really.
And I think even within evangelicalism, you know, I saw a recent Instagram by a big evangelical Anglican congregation. We have woke, you know, like with a, and I thought, gosh, they, you know, okay, they're in a student population, but they're more usually suited to this sort of appeal of what. The kind of alpha, charismatic renewal How are they going to translate that into that? I watched the videos, and on the whole, actually, it's pretty benign. They haven't really. They've just used the branding. You know, okay, fair enough. But I think that's been the big frustration, is that my superiors, many of them, are thinking that the woke narrative is what's going to win the game. You know, this is the route to revival.
And really,
everything in my heart and head says no, this is not the way forward, you know. And be very careful of this. But
I'm a little curious. So my whole life, you know, my father's ministry, my ministry has very much been amongst African-American populations, inner city. In America, we've got this, you know, long reckoning of the consequences of slavery and then Jim Crow and the civil rights movement. How does that play out in the UK? Is it about colonialism or Africa? I mean, how does that play out? What are you repenting of now as the Church of England that in such a way that supports supposed to bring the masses back to church?
I think two things. One, on the sort of racial ethnic thing, it is definitely the colonial thing. And the Archbishop of Canterbury, I forget where it was now, somewhere in India, he lay prostrate in front of some particular memorial to something that had happened 150 years ago by the British Army, you know, that's kind of known in India, but not so known here. So there is the kind of colonial guilt thing.
Do people sense that? I mean, you're a pastor of a local church, so do regular people sense this, or is that just kind of like?
No. It's just, I don't think it's on people's minds. I suppose the second thing might be the Windrush generation, which is the people who came over, particularly from the Caribbean. And you can make a point, actually, that a very valid point, that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people from those islands came over here and got a pretty rough treatment. And, you know, elements of the Church of England were quite snooty to them. So there's some kind of there's been a sort of a whole national thing about that. And I think, that the church probably has some soul searching to do in that respect. And quite frankly, did a whole home goal in the 1950s and 60s, because a lot of these people came with enormous faith enthusiasm, you know, and were deeply small-o orthodox. You know, C.S. Lewis would say supernatural Christians. And were somewhat kind of marginalized and ended up founding lots of Pentecostal churches or house churches. Who can blame them? I think the other sort of issues are not so much that in the church is repenting, but it's more that the Church of England's role has been so marginalized over the years, and you know, congregational sizes have diminished, that there's a kind of heart-searching, heart-rendering about who do we reach out to. You know, if I was to be cynical, I'd say there's a marketing exercise that's going on.
I see that in North American denominations as well. I see, you know, maybe even my own, I'm not sure, but I think exactly what you just said. I think even some very conservative denominations are out of a sense of white guilt or something, saying, well, if we can sort of fly the right flags and install the right language, then somehow we'll get a pass on, you know, we won't be called racist, or, you know, we will have been seen a being on the right side of history and atoning, and then people will come. And I've seen, you know, the mainline has tried this with the rainbow flag and the LGBT things, and, you know, people, they'll get applause, but people won't come. They'll say, oh, glad you're finally waking up to our cause and our movement. So wonderful. We're really happy for you, but they're not going to start coming to church, because why should they? Oop, just lost your picture again. There we go.
No, that's okay. I think that one of the things that affects that, it's such a kind of long history really on this within Anglicanism, you know, this kind of angst to be culturally appropriate. You interviewed Tom Holland.
Yeah.
Not so long ago. And he said recently, why is the Church of England trying to become like the Liberal Democrat Party, which is a sort of minority party, which is very, very into the woke at the moment, very left-leaning. When I could just join the Liberal Democrats, you know, and have Sunday off.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, nothing wrong. If you want to join the Liberal Democrats, fine. Nothing wrong with that. But, you know, many people
why go to church?
Go to a car boot sale instead, you know.
Yeah. That's the same on this side.
And I think that's kind of one of the issues. And you end up with this discord within congregational life is that on the whole, most C of E congregations are probably quite conservative in their kind of outlook and the newspapers they read. Whereas the clergy are very frustrated because they tend to be, you know, more Guardian reading, whereas the congregations are more Telegraph readers. And so, you know, you kind of end up with, I remember as a friend of mine said, it's as if the vicar on Sunday morning is telling us off. Reading the wrong newspaper, you know, that's the sort of subtle message, and it irks. I suppose I've reflected upon this. Oh, can I just go and tell my?
Sure. I'll pause. So it's and I think you said it well. It's almost as if the vicar on Sunday morning is telling us off. I mean, it's
I think one of the things that kind of formed me was when I opened that little Good News Bible at 17 and saw Love Your Enemies. I found that incredibly. I sound a bit like Jonathan Pageau here. I found the highest code, you know, the highest code on the pyramid. This was it. This was, you know, when you go to the pearly gates, this is how you're going to be judged. How did you love your enemies? Not how did you get on well with your family and your friends and the people who agreed with you, but, you know, how did you do that? Or did you divide the world into them and us? At the time, I took a college unit in theology, high school, what we call A-level. And I did a project on liberation theology, which I began really enthusiastic. I admired the cooperatives and the engagement with real world issues. And I thought, this is great. But the more I read, I started getting chilled at the end because, you know, I was writing this round about the time that the Berlin Wall was beginning to fall apart. In fact, a few months later, I'd be at university with a college friend of mine who was doing Soviet history studies. As the wall fell down, we went into the courtyard and burnt his notes. And he said, I think I'm going to do another course. You know, that was useless. Completely useless. Now let's go back, let's do medieval history or Victorians or something. But So I wrote this little dissertation for high school on liberation theology, beginning enthusiastically and ending thinking, this is dividing the world into them and us. Mm. And I felt there wasn't enough Jesus in it. There was a lot of Moses, a lot about liberation and power and what have you, but there wasn't, there didn't seem to be that kind of compassion to love one's, the imagination, compassion to love one's enemy. It seemed to be a a very black and white version of Christianity. And of course, then I read later on this whole thing about the Marxist lens, and I didn't know critical theory, all that stuff, but that's essentially what I was reading. And I was seeing it being played out in college and university with friends who were attracted to a radical theology, that there was something that sat really uncomfortable in my gut. And I thought, can I divide the world up in this way? Can I spaghettify it? I can't without somehow disrespecting that first bit of scripture that I really truly read. And that in the end, the gospel has to be about, fundamentally about love rather than a claim for power. And if that subtlety is lost on people, tough luck, you know, but that's going to be my operating system.
So
so that's where it's kind of been. That's been, I've had the same theology since I was 17. I read lots of C.S. Lewis. Frances, my wife, who's about to start training for ministry, she's read a lot. We're both great C.S. Lewis fans, and we enjoy, you know, all things Narnia. And I probably bore the congregation to death on Jack. I think he's, you know, he's the prophet of the age in that respect. And I think that old priest gave, I can remember he gave me Miracles, the first book to read.
Really?
And then The Great Divorce.
Yeah.
And I was hooked.
Wow.
Then Mere Christianity. And I was just blown away by this. And thought, why hadn't I ever read any of this before? You know, why aren't people talking about this all the time? Yeah. And loved it. You know, the day trip to heaven out of Greytown. And Screwtape Letters. Yeah. I just thought, there is a psychology for the human person that is so much more superior than Jung or Freud. You know, as much as I like Jordan's stuff, I think Screwtape Letters probably has the edge on it in terms of really getting between the bone and the marrow about what it means to be a human being and how easily it is to be duped. Tough but grace-filled is the spiritual journey. And I suppose that's what I feel that's missing. That's what I liked about and like about Jordan's work. And, you know, it was just so awful to hear about his recent illnesses. You know, if I could write him a card and say thank you for really knocking new atheism on the head, and for showing us that there's this incredible constituency. You know, you don't know me from Adam, but I just want to say thank you, Jordan, for showing that. You know, because that's such a precious thing. At this time, to be given that hope for mission.
Now, recently you wrote a piece for The Spectator. How did that come about? So let's talk about that. And I'll put the link in the notes so people can read it.
It's one of those sort of pinch me moments, really, where I was having my porridge. And doing what I try not to do, which is, you know, look at Twitter rather than a spiritual book. And one of the editors of The Spectator, I think it was Fraser Nelson, put up this tweet about us all needing the courage to go out and engage with the world, you know, to get the British economy up and running, to reboot things. And I saw that no one had made any comments. It was, you know, it must have been about 7:30 in the morning. So I just typed in, well, you know, I agree, but it's a shame that the official Church of England hasn't been part of that courage narrative. I can't remember the exact words, but it's something along those lines. And this is a real problem. You know, this is a kind of existential issue that that the churches need to need not to be sort of just providers of health and safety guidance, but you know, need to go into that territory of how can I as a person be faith-filled and be a courage provider, or receive courage, or experience the kind of courage that's going to be needed for the next months and years ahead. So he just sent me a message back. I don't think I've must be one of the first people I've ever had an email on Twitter from, whatever, 100 followers or whatever. I said, oh, what's this? You know, there's a little circle on the letter bit. For, almost, this must be an email. And clicked it, and there it is. He said, you know, that's a really interesting tweet. Would you like to write 800 words, you know, by tomorrow evening?
So, didn't give you a lot of time to think about it.
I sat down and began composing this. I can remember I went to our church, you know, sort of locked myself in the church, huge bits of paper with black marker pens writing out. I thought, let's write out 8 paragraphs and mix them all up and see how it fits. Sent it to them, and a sub-editor processed it. Had this amazing ability to rewrite what I'd written and make it sound like it was somehow a conversation going in my head. I think I thought, oh, spectator readers would want, you know, a very erudite essay. But it seems like, no, they want to feel like I'm kind of almost like I'm vlogging to them, you know. And in that, I had a go at the official church, and then mentioned Jordan Peterson in the whole context of, you know, this is the kind of message that we need. Is it's not a woke fueled one or a health and safety guidance, but you know, something along the lines of, come on, let's find the courage to go out, you know. And I just love that incident, you know, where he challenged a student about the cleanliness of their room, wasn't it? It was something like, before you change the world, Sonny, go and
get Peterson,
your room in order, you know. And I thought, you know, I think this is what we need to hear from our church leaders, our ministers and bishops, you know. A kind of tough love would work quite well at the moment. You know, I say that as a person, of course, who's, you know, incredibly nice and not really a tough love person. but you know, we need some tough love. And I think that's, to me, that's that would be a very good ingredient into the mix. And then I also mentioned C.S. Lewis, you know, his famous quote about if you look for heaven, you get earth as well. And if you look only for earth, you get nothing. Yeah. And this is one of the theological issues that really is. Our horizons are kind of curled in on themselves. If you go down the woke theology line, you end up with just, you know, kind of utopian dreams, really, rather than that other horizon, you know, that faraway country. So I mentioned, I threw him in, and I threw in Rod Dreher, who's...
Yeah, how did you find Dreher? Because, you know, he pretty much writes American stuff. He's on the American Conservative. Yeah. How'd you run across him?
Well, I was very lucky at seminary that we had an ethics moral philosophy lecturer who was crazy about Alistair McIntyre. And he made us read After Virtue. I mean, he dragged us through every chapter of that with, you know, there we were with dictionaries and encyclopedias trying to figure out every turgid sentence of this, what is actually a fantastic book. I mean, but boy, it's a real, real hard read. And we came out with this sense, you know, of MacIntyre's prophecy at the end of a new Benedict, and the barbarians are not at the gates, but they've been running the show for some time. You know, we were sort of radicalized in MacIntyre, and I thank him for that. And that stayed with me. So when I'd heard, I don't know where I'd heard it, online or at a theological bookshop, somehow I tripped upon this, that, oh, here's this guy writing, he's picked up on MacIntyre. I'd also been involved a little bit in New Monasticism, and I got a bit kind of disgruntled with it. And I think I'd started off reading Bonhoeffer and what have you. And we've set up a little intern community house here for young adults. I found a lot of the other people doing New Monasticism, it was largely a kind of, it had none of that MacIntyre vision of a radical Christian life, but it was rather sort of, well, here, if you, around here we have a town called Totnes, which is a kind of New Age capital of Britain, next to Glastonbury. Glastonbury is the heart, Totnes is the head. And so we'd say it's a bit Totnes. You know, a lot of the new monastic communities are very, very Totnes, you know, into sort of stones and candles. And I got quite despondent about that, that they seem to have no sense of the culture war or how we are to live within that. And but here's, you know, Dreher's book dropped out of the sky to me a couple of years ago, pretty much about the same time as Jordan's work. And I thought, gosh, these two guys, along with C.S. Lewis, you know, they're really saying something. We need to tune into this. And I just thought Rod Dreher just communicated this so well. I mean, it hasn't been a book that's really travelled across the Atlantic well. I mean, hopefully his new one, Live Not By Lies, which is a bit closer to home with this. He's given me a copy to read before it's published on Kindle. And, you know, it really picks up on the kind of Soviet, the heroes in Soviet time, who lived the Christian faith in the underground church. So that was my spectator essay. You know, so I wrote this and said, you know, if we're not careful, we're going to end up with an underground church.
And what do you mean by that?
I don't know really, but I do know a bit because we have a guy here who lodges with us, a family friend of old who grew up in Czechoslovakia during those times. You know, was part of the sort of secret youth camps and things that churches had. A number of his brothers were ordained in the Roman Catholic Church. He knew a lot of the writings of the philosophers and thinkers of the time, people like Václav Havel, what have you. So I suppose one's looking at, what do I mean by the underground church?
Well, when you say that, I mean, it's an interesting thing to say in because one of the differences between the UK and the US is, of course, the COV is still sort of state church. And of course, in the United States, we don't have a state church. But an underground church, of course, harkens back to Soviet or China or something like that. But here you've got a church that is, you know, official, but did you see Tom Holland's remarks when he was on Unbelievable with Justin Brierley?
I think I did, yes.
Yeah, because Tom Holland, I was seriously, that almost made a video, but but Tom Holland's comments in that video were quite profound and prophetic in terms of the Church of England, saying something very similar to the effect that this is a moment where the church should rise, and the church seems this church seems to be fulfilling all of the bad stereotypes everyone has sort of believed about the church.
Yeah. No, that's one of the issues. Yeah. And I think that culture has, I'll use that word, that narrative has been around not only just for the last 2-3 years, but it's been around for, you know, a couple of generations with the church's crisis with the 1960s and how to adjust to a fast change paced world. So I suppose what is an underground church? Well, it sounds very melodramatic, doesn't it? But I think actually, probably initially, it's clergy and laity, but particularly laity, you know, supporting each other. It's about supporting home life, the domestic church. It's about catechesis. It's about sharing the resources. If things got really bad and we start getting cancelled and no platformed
by your own, but by your own church. I mean, that's the irony of this, which is, you know, in the communist world, the church went underground, you know, from the government, but you going underground, avoiding your own church hierarchy. I mean, there's something deeply Protestant about that. Deeply American too, because I mean, because that's sort of, you wouldn't see that in North America as much because pastors tend to be just sort of so rebellious anyway, that to break off and do their own thing. I mean, the non-denominational world, that's practically the modus operandi of the non-denomination world, but the C of E, I mean, so again, I think you saying that just sort of sets up a particular image given your context.
Well, I think that's the big difference, isn't it, across the Atlantic here. And I suppose you see it to some respect in Catholic Europe. You know, that there it tends to be one denomination that has the whole franchise. And breakoffs aren't really that successful. I think what's interesting in the Soviet model, and I'm thinking aloud here, is that these groups kind of just went under the radar and submerged a bit. It wasn't that they created breakaway churches, it's that they created enough of what they needed to support each other and to keep going what they felt was, you know, the Orthodox faith. Mm-hmm. I think breakaway churches in the UK have a very poor history.
It's interesting. Because my roots are in the Christian Reformed Church, which in the early part of the 19th century broke away from the state church in the Netherlands over, you know, one of the things was who got to name the clergy. And so the congregation, chose their own ministers. And so Henrik de Kock was, you know, went to jail for a while. And then the government thought this is a bad look, you know, imprisoning ministers that a congregation wants. So they kind of gave up. And then this little split off church went their own way. But, you know, again, to have getting into your story now, the idea behind the new monasticism, but again, seeing it sort of get lost. And I can very much see the strains of this coming in and why you wrote what you wrote. And COVID, here in the United States, they've had an increasingly, you know, when COVID first hit, you know, nobody knew what to do. So it's like, well, okay, well, you know, we don't want our elderly getting sick. So, you know, let's shut down and try and make a way. And the longer we go, the state of California, for example, their you know, they sort of got sued because we have these amendments to the Constitution that sort of back the state up a little bit from the church sometimes. And so then the governor of California was saying, no singing. And I'm like, I'm not sure he can give an order like that. We can talk, but not sing. I mean, where's this going? And so it's, you know, it's been sort of a game back and forth between the state and the church. But at some point, you know, I think as Tom Holland had noted in that conversation with Justin Brierley, and as you noted in your piece, at some point the church has to ask itself some rather foundational questions about, well, what business are we really in? Yeah. And I think for a state church in particular, I would imagine that's been a far longer running conversation given the connection between church and state that you'd have in your context.
Yeah, definitely. It's, I think it's complicated by, you know, religious history and a sense of British sensibility of not wanting to upset the apple cart. I suppose particularly an English sense of wanting to be fair to all sides, you know, and find the balance. You know, now some of that can be healthy, can be Benedictine. But, you know, some of it in the end can be no help at all. You know, it struck me as it's no coincidence in Lewis's sci-fi trilogy, in the last one, The Hideous Strength, that the organization that is doing so much destruction is called NICE.
Yes.
That was chosen for very, very specific reasons.
Indeed. Indeed.
Yes, we're haunted by, you know, religious wars and divisions. But we have to kind of move beyond that as well. But as a sort of religious culture, I think we, you know, we have what we have, you know, and the Church of England really, in many ways, is the only game in town. And I think for many of us, you know, that probably what might mean in the future, you know, kind of ducking and diving a bit and working around some things and networking a bit more, being a bit more specific in our catechetical work, being a bit more specific, like the Benedict option says in terms of the domestic church.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the hilarious things that came out of the Church of England website a couple of months ago, the beginning of lockdown, was this whole thing of, now we're all returning to the domestic church. You know, someone in Church House decided that this would be a really interesting point to put on the website. You know, now we can just go back to the domestic church and that will be fine. But the thing is, we've never really tended that garden. We've never invested in that.
Yep.
We've largely made Sunday Christians with a dash of woke, you know.
just for the brochures.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it just... And that's a completely different sphere to say, you know, what Rod Dreher is saying.
Yeah. So Dreher contacted you. Why? What did he want to talk about?
I got another one of those emails on Twitter. Right there, I was like, ooh, I'm getting two of these. Pressed it, and it was like, you know, someone just pinged this to me. I was watching a movie late at night, and this kind of pinged through. And I loved your article. How can I help? Do you want? And I said, well, yeah. How can I help? And can we talk? And so within a couple of days, yeah, I had a couple of hours conversation with him, real heart to heart, with a genuine guy, fantastic. Which is kind of amazing for me, because I think he's as a writer, I know he's not a theologian, but officially, but I think he's a theological rock star, you know, because this is amazing. And it was just a genuine person with a deep heart for the gospel and understanding of the cost of it.
Yeah. So have you had any pushback from your superiors in any of this? I mean, you wrote something. I mean, sometimes yeah. breaking ranks.
Well, I'm very lucky that the local hierarchy, the local bishop, is very supportive.
Good.
Yeah, and a real friend in that respect. And local congregation think it's fantastic. they're retired accountants and bankers and managers and people who worked in the City of London. I was writing to a constituency of, locally, if I wrote in the parish magazine, to write Spectator style would sort of please them. You know, but, so this wasn't anything kind of, I got slaps on the back, actually, from everyone. I've not had any pushback as yet. I've had quite a lot of encouraging emails from clergy saying, thank you for what you wrote. And the Spectator of, they said, please write more. So I don't know where I go with that. I mean, I've written one more on statues. I don't know if you saw that piece.
No, I haven't
yet. I wrote one on statues and white Jesus. Because there was this guy, Sean King. It's a big
thing. Yeah.
I'd never heard of Sean King, but dear Archbishop of Canterbury was very naughty. Radio 4, which in this country is like a very kind of highbrow radio station, BBC do, and they interviewed him on the Today program. Again, it's a kind of a 3-hour news program, and he got the 8:10 slot. And after 15 minutes of quite a reasonable interview, it's that bit when journalists are going to put in the bit they really want to ask you. That they said, well, this is a guy called Sean King who said some stuff about there's too many white pictures of Jesus. And his grace, probably a bit tired at this point, just saying, he makes a good point. Clearly had not read the tweet, which says, pull them down, smash them, and all of this, this inflammatory piece. So I wrote a piece around that without kind of re-mentioning names or stuff, but on the essence that, if we give an inch, people will take a mile. And actually, again, this is another Jordan Peterson thing about low resolution and high resolution discussions. And if the Church of England narrative is low resolution when it comes to art, if it's just looking at it through the political lens, it's really not doing it as a service. I'll just put my charger in before we disappear. We're very primitive. And so I went down to my church and found 18 stained glass depictions of Christ. And he all looks like, Swedish Richard the Lionheart, kind of long robe, sandals type thing. It's a Victorian church. And I thought, I'll count them out. 18, goodness, is more than I thought. And none of them look particularly Middle Eastern, and so did a bit of research on it. Appreciate that image came out of the Gothic Revival, which came and the Pre-Raphaelites, Holman Hunt, where we have a connection as a parish with Keble College in Oxford, which has the original Holman Hunt, "I stand at the door and knock." Yeah, and it's an arts and crafts Jesus. Jesus returning to the kind of hippiedom of, I'm at one with my masculinity and femininity. I've got long hair and a beard and a robe, and you know, I'm back to the carpentry shop. I've given up the Industrial Revolution. You know, that to me, that's the high resolution discussion.
Yeah,
that's where
that's right.
those pictures come from.
You know, right.
It's appealing to that part of the Victorian soul that felt wary of mechanization.
Yeah,
it's got nothing to do with some kind of political colonial or whatever.
Well, it has to do with its political colonial its place in it, and that's the point with art, that all of these images are expressing, you know, this moment in time. So I grew up in, you know, Patterson, 60s, 70s, a lot of black Jesuses in Patterson. And for me growing up, they were fairly common. Well, this was racial reconciliation, you know, fairly strong themes of liberation, and the communities are going to the community expression of Jesus. They're not thinking, okay, we want to somehow depict first century Judea. There, Jesus is cast. Well, even so, nobody in all my time here has ever commented that I've been doing videos on this representation of Jesus, which is a famous one. And there are various, we got a Gandhi here, and I think we got a Niebuhr in there. So, I mean, this is art, and this was given to me, well, by an intern who served with me and shared, you know, the backgrounds of this. So you have Jonas Salk, you have Robert Kennedy, you know, you've got John F. Kennedy, you've got Pope John the 23rd, Martin Luther King Jr., Bishop Fulton J. Sheen, a couple more popes, Henry Luce, Alexander Graham Bell. I mean, those are all the faces that make up this Jesus. And, you know, yeah, there's a lot you could talk about with something like this. And so have the conversation. It's art. This is what it's for. But, you know, people see my, I'll put it up a little bit later. People see my Jordan Peterson, which, you know, and this is special to me, because after I had made my first video that kind of got some attention, then a man walks into church, says, "I've never been to church before in my life. This is for you." And actually, he's still very much with us. He's helping me try and get our streaming up to speed. And he helped me start the meetup and helped start the Discord server. And so, you know, this gift from him is a special gift, just like this gift from an intern who is now a pastor in Kalamazoo is a gift.
Wow.
What are you gonna do? And there's gonna be members of my audience that have problems with this. And it's like,
maybe they want some of them deleted.
we're gonna rub out some of these faces in here. Okay. You know, so this is, and the thing is, if you're a pastor of a church, well, I know sometimes people are like really, they're like really sensitive if they're gonna say something that differs from a, like, you know, hey, you know, if I had real thin skin, I would have never made it long in this profession. Every week you stand up and deliver the word of God, and some people sleep and other people just, you know, blow you off. And
some people tweet.
Yeah. Some people are check the fantasy football scores. I'm a pastor of a local church. This is normal. Oh, Sean King. Oh, that's funny. That's funny. So, where do you want this thing to go for you? Are you going to keep writing? I'm going to put you on the channel now, so you'll get a little bit more visibility, and some people will write to you.
I think so. It's sort of baby steps, and it's been interesting. And I suppose it's the accumulation of years of thinking, probably overthinking, but thinking certainly about this. And, I've had people, one or two people have said, why bother? You know, you're in a lovely parish. If I turn the camera, well, you won't be able to quite see it, but I've got the sea just out there.
You know, oh, nice.
5 minutes from the beach. Just keep your head down and don't say anything. And I think, I've got a place that's very special here and safe. That's a good foundation to be able to write and to communicate from. We have a little bit of Christendom here that's still, you know, a very strong community, a very kind of traditional community in its own way that has great hospitality. That community has been a brilliant mentor to me. So I can't just treat the rest of my life as a sort of clerical holiday, you know. And I think since 17, I read about love your enemies. So there's a sense of, you know, you've got to go with that. And
maybe you'll have some enemies to love now.
Yeah. Well, that's another article, isn't it?
Yes. Congratulations, you have enemies. Now you get to practice what you've preached.
I think I found that last year, particularly occasionally dipping my toe into Twitter, that there would be people, church people, clergy, whatever, who could be really quite incensed if you said something that slightly contradicted.
Yeah.
Or I would try this occasional. I would see someone who'd said something ridiculous, theologically ridiculous, and just say, "Do you really mean that? Or is there not a greater discussion?" And you get the, "You bigot, stay out of this." And I'm like, "I'm just asking, you know." I'm just asking. I'm not kind of like, I'm fluent in nice. I found that initially really, really difficult to see. And you had to kind of, it's not that I had to develop a thick skin so much, but you had to kind of know where to put that in your brain.
Yeah.
Where to park it. Because otherwise you could end up all night thinking, my goodness, you know. How do I deal with that argument? I'm particularly, and always have been, very pro-life. The product of a teenage pregnancy. And all the philosophical stuff around that, about us being created in the image of God and life being sacred. That's always meant. I mean, I'm not militantly out on it, but it's something that's very sort of precious to me as a concept. It's a big part of my life, and occasionally when I've questioned some people, some Christian people on that, and seen the response, think, is that the level of conversation that you? You want. So I kind of had to learn to say, let's just move on, shake the dust off your feet and move on, and don't worry about it, because there's a lot of people out there who are into this sort of vindictive doublespeak.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what we're facing right now is the vindictive doublespeak. It's a good way to say it.
So, Paul, I probably will be collecting adversaries and enemies.
Oh, there you go. Well, more enemies to love. There. There are worse things that you could have, I suppose. Well, this has been wonderful, Daniel. I'll put the links to your pieces in the notes here. Any final thoughts or words or things you wanted to bring up that we didn't get to?
Well, I'll be able to listen to this when the gym opens next week.
Well, I hope COVID goes the right direction in your country here in California. Yeah. We seem to be moving in the wrong direction again. So,
Well, thank you for everything you do. In the last few years, I feel really blessed to have come upon a number of people like yourself who have just given us intellectual moral courage.
Well, I'm happy to play whatever part I can that's helpful. beautiful talking to you, Daniel.
Thank you very much.
I'll post this tomorrow so you can listen to yourself.
Oh, my Lord. God bless, Paul.
Have a good evening.
You take care.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.